Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 108 on Friday, August 13, 2010. I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts this week. The city's pretty sleepy here in the late summer, except for one enterprising bike thief who managed to snatch my new hybrid bicycle right from the backyard on Tuesday when we were inside the house dozing. I'm keeping the replacement bike that I bought safely in the locked garage, but today being Friday the 13th, the garage door keypad stopped working, and in the process of trying to reprogram it, I left the remote control inside the garage as the door mysteriously closed. A costly service call yielded the solution I wished I'd thought of myself, a new 9-volt battery. Well, compared with that, my interview guest luck has been going pretty well lately. Russ Grandinetti, Amazon's Vice President for Kindle Content, spoke with me from Seattle and gave his enthusiastic review of the 2 weeks since Amazon announced its next generation of smaller, lighter, faster, and in the case of the Wi-Fi model, cheaper Kindles. I asked him about social media, Google Editions, and whether or not we need to worry about Kindle 3 shortages. Here's an excerpt in which Russ suggests that the Kindle is transforming the reading of books into a less solitary activity.
Over time, our behavior and our awareness about reading being social may well increase because the tools allow that to happen.
In news, I'll catch up with a rumor that Amazon is planning to make it possible to give Kindle books as gifts. Also, Plastic Logic pulls the plug on its elegant Q e-reader. The National Federation of the Blind has nice words to say about the company whose Kindle DX university trial the Federation opposed last year in a lawsuit. And finally, that wild and crazy blogger Mike Kane makes a maybe not so crazy case for why Amazon should buy Barnes & Noble. For the tech tip, I will tell you about a way to give your delete button a rest when you want to delete more than just a few characters of text that you've typed on your Kindle keyboard. In content, you'll hear how an iconic New York writer who has never read an ebook agreed to Little Brown & Company's proposal that he publish his next nonfiction book in ebook form only this fall. I'm going to have a special announcement at the end of this episode on a new project that Ken Clark and I will launch next week as part of eBooks for Troops. Here's a hint. If you're itching to pre-order a Kindle 3, but you can't figure out what to do with your trusty Kindle 2, we will offer a useful and satisfying way to solve your problem. With that, let's turn to the news. First item in news is one that I caught up with this week in an August 2nd post at a blog named Me and My Kindle, which made its debut in October of last year, and it looks like a good source of Kindle-related news and opinion. At Telluride.com, I learned that the blogger's name is John Cogg, so I want to thank John for pointing me to a July 30th PC World post by Lance Ulanov that I'd overlooked. It looks as if Lance was one of the reporters briefed on the new Kindle by Amazon's Russ Grandinetti when Lance asked Russ how come we can't give Kindle books to each other without a gift card. Russ replied, quote, "Stay tuned. We know gifting is important. We have a long experience with trying to make people's holidays really good." And Lance wrote, Russ added that Amazon is working on making this year's holidays good. At first, I thought this was great news, but when I told my wife Darlene about it just now, she said, "I'm not sure I like it. I don't want people to be able to put books on my Kindle without my permission." I argued that it's no different than someone buying me a paper book for Christmas that ends up on my bookshelf and maybe or maybe not gets read. But I sort of see what Darlene's saying because my Kindle is a pretty personal zone of reading material at this point that I gather and organize myself, so I can kind of understand her qualms. So maybe there might be a chance to opt into this new capability if it's really coming as rumored, in which you could let Amazon know that your Kindle is open for gifts or maybe not. I'd be interested in what you think on this one. You could drop me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. Would you like it if your favorite aunt could just send you a book to your Kindle, as opposed to giving you a gift card at Amazon that you could use for Kindle purchase, or not? Kind of an interesting option. I think in general it's a good idea, and it sounds like it's probably coming. Item two in news, the Plastic Logic Q Pro Reader was abandoned this week, a sad event in my mind because I was very taken with the Q and the Plastic Logic team when Darlene and I had a chance to meet them in person at the CES show in Las Vegas 7 months ago, way back in the pre-iPad era. The Q booth was one of the hot spots of the show, a shoulder-to-shoulder buzz zone as we crowded in to admire the very thin, less than 1 pound e-ink display aimed at business users and priced at $649 and $799. In a Kindle Chronicles extra that I posted from the show, I asked Plastic Logic's Senior Director of Marketing, Maureen Mellon, how she thought the Q would fare against the color tablets that we all knew were coming from Apple and others. Here's what she had to say then.
And it's a really good question. What we see this product as is, number one, it's very light. It's under a pound. It's easy to carry around. It's also doesn't use much power. So if you look at the tablets, they use much more power. So our product actually lasts like a week or longer between charges, depending on how much wireless you use. But because of the fact that we do use the e-ink screen, what you find is when you're not using the product, it doesn't use any power unless your wireless is on. So we're talking about days and weeks, not, you know, hours of battery time. So that's really helpful to people.
As I listened to Maureen's hopeful assessment of how the Q would stack up against Apple's as yet unseen tablet at the time I spoke with her, I see that what she and many others didn't anticipate was that the iPad would weigh only about a pound and a half, that its battery would last a good 10 hours, and that the entry-level model would cost $150 less than the Q. Those impressive design successes rendered the Q's advantages less dramatic and certainly not worth the price premium. This actually helps me understand the wisdom of Amazon's third-generation Kindle design, which was just released or announced, because it widens the Kindle's advantage over the iPad in size, weight, battery life to a full month without the wireless on, for goodness sake, and perhaps most importantly, price, with the new Wi-Fi-only Kindle costing just $139 and the 3G model priced at $189 with no monthly charge for 3G access. Plastic Logic's CEO this week said the company plans to re-enter the market with a next-generation Pro Reader. I wish them well and can only imagine the disappointment that Maureen and others are feeling given their justifiable enthusiasm for a beautiful and innovative product. Those sample cues that we all were drooling over at CES one day will maybe be a worthy museum piece illustrating how fierce the e-reader competition became in 2010, some 560 years after Gutenberg introduced movable type. Item three in news, in June of last year, the National Federation of the Blind sued Arizona State University to prevent the school from using the Kindle DX in a higher education test. The Federation at that time argued that despite the Kindle's text-to-speech capability, blind students could not operate the device, and that put them at a disadvantage over sighted students in violation of federal law. I have to admit that at the time I thought the suit, which was eventually settled at no cost to Amazon, but an agreement to, you know, move in the direction that the Federation was working toward, I thought it was pretty rough treatment for a company that even then was pioneering technology of huge benefit to the visually impaired, especially compared with the non-existent accessibility of e-readers introduced by Sony, Barnes & Noble, and the Kobo Consortium. But the Federation is known for pursuing its laudable mission with vigor and sharp elbows. This week, they issued a press release commending Amazon on, quote, the unveiling of a new Kindle that blind and print disabled people can use. That was nice, but I thought it was a bit of a reach too far when Dr. Mark Maurer, president of the Federation, added in the release that, quote, the National Federation of the Blind has long been urging Amazon to make its reading device accessible, and we are pleased that our efforts have come to fruition. Well, I've no doubt that the Federation's efforts did keep the heat on Amazon to solve the accessibility challenge, so the organization probably does deserve some credit for that. But in my opinion, the lion's share of the credit certainly has to go to the crew at Amazon's Lab 126, who managed to include this very significant improvement in the Kindle 3 while still reducing the size and weight and keeping the price low enough to be more affordable than ever. And finally in news, Mike Kane, who at his blog, which is titled Mike Kane's iPad Test, describes himself as, quote, a pain in the ass who won't go away, and it also says he hates cowards, suits, and ass kissers. He came up with a bold suggestion in the wake of recent news that Barnes & Noble's board has put itself up for sale, has put the company up for sale. In a 15-point post dated August 3rd, Mike argued that Amazon should buy Barnes & Noble and its 720 stores. Here's a sample. Reason number three is, quote, Amazon could swiftly put EPUB to death in one shot and transition all Nook buyers to Kindle format without requiring ebook repurchasing. Four, Amazon would have the major presence in book buying and force the industry into the 21st century. Also, he writes, the Amazon store as a name has better brand recognition worldwide. They'd become tourist stops like the Apple store. Per square foot traffic and revenue would skyrocket. And also, quote, Amazon merchandise. How many tourists will leave with a t-shirt, a hat, a carry bag, a Kindle case? Mike ends his post with this simple exhortation. Don't wait, Bezos. Pounce. Well, I can't imagine that Amazon would even consider abandoning its online identity, which is at this point so far just kind of the key part of its corporate mission and presence in the world. But Mike Kane's proposal makes for a good read, and if Amazon does make this unlikely pounce, I hope you'll remember that you heard it first from Mike Kane and second from the Kindle Chronicles. Time now for a quick tech tip via the Me and My Kindle blog and a link to it by Paul Biba at telereed.com. I was reminded of a good time-saving tip that I don't think I've mentioned before in the podcast. If you've typed something in a note or a long search term or anything else with your Kindle keyboard and you want to delete the whole thing, simply hold down the Alt key as you press delete. And presto, you'll save yourself a whole bunch of single character deletions. Since joining Amazon in January of 1998, Russell Grandinetti has held key positions as treasurer, director for investor relations, and vice president for books. He is currently Amazon's vice president for Kindle content, in which capacity he and other Amazon execs fanned out across the country to do embargoed preview demos of the Kindle 3 on July 26th, which is when I had my preview in Boston with another Kindle executive, Jay Marine. The plan was to conduct an on-the-record follow-up interview the Thursday after the new Kindle was officially announced, but since Darlene and I were tied up in Fairbanks that day, Stephanie Mantello, senior public relations manager for the Kindle, graciously agreed to delay my follow-up interview until this week. I spoke with Russ on Wednesday, August 11, and began by asking him to characterize the overall reaction to news of the Kindle 3 2 weeks after its introduction.
Well, I think it's been great. We're quite gratified by the coverage and the reception that we've gotten so far. Obviously, we've known for a long time what we've been working on, and it's a lot of fun to finally get the chance to share it with the world outside. And we've been very gratified by the reaction so far. I personally had the opportunity to meet with a number of reporters around the announcement time and to show people the device in person. And frankly, that's been even better because I think when you look at the list of all the new features that we've put in the device, each one of them are, I think, really great steps forward. But the way the whole thing hangs together, I think the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, frankly. And I think when people get it in their hands, they'll see exactly what I mean.
So when Jay Marine gave me the demo with Stephanie in Boston, he had a dramatic moment of pulling it out of his sports coat pocket. Was that did all of you have the same bit of theater there?
Because it was very effective. I actually also did that same move. I didn't coordinate with Jay. It's interesting we both did the same thing, but it really, you know, it brings it home when a device like that does fit so easily in the inside pocket of your jacket. You could walk around with it, and yet still it's that same size 6-inch screen, and has all the features that people know and love, and frankly better features,
yeah,
battery life in contrast and all those things. So that, it's kind of fun. The size and weight piece is fun, but really kind of, you know, I have to turn around and ask you what you thought when you held it in your hands. I think the whole thing, you know, when it, the way it hangs together is really pretty incredible.
Well, I agree. I do think that the reduction in size and weight is dramatic, because when I held my current Kindle in the left hand and the new one in the right hand, you know, instantly the current one felt older.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's sort of a move toward the next modern thing by succeeding on the weight and the size.
Yeah. What'll happen is, and you know, this is very, very typical of technology and internet-based evolution, is, you know, it really is a little bit of a wow when you see the next generation of something, because you've gotten used to the older generation. And then very quickly people will be annoyed at, you know, older generation size and weight.
Yeah, exactly. So it starts looking, you know, like
they'll develop a new normal very quickly.
Exactly. Well, were you surprised that it sold out in just 4 days? Was the demand kind of overwhelming?
Yeah, I think these things are always very difficult to predict, and we've been very gratified by the response, both from current Kindle device owners that want to upgrade, as well as, you know, just new folks. We were optimistic that that we'd do well, but you know, clearly demand has outstripped our ability to supply units in the short term. Although we don't think that it's a very long term phenomenon.
Yeah, I see that. I just checked, and the current estimated ship date is still holding at September 8th.
Yep.
It'd gone. And so you're optimistic that we're not going to be seeing chronic shortages.
It's our hope, and we think we're certainly, we've worked very hard over the last couple of years to be set up to not go out of stock for any length of time, and we hate it when we do, or even if we just have to push the date a few days. And so that's a disappointment in some respects. But we feel pretty good about our ability to keep up with demand.
Hmm. What do you think in the coverage so far is the improvement in the new Kindle that's been the most overlooked so far?
Probably two I'd just pick are, one is, I think until you see the device, what we just talked about, the size and weight thing, is a little bit, it's just hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And screen contrast is a very difficult thing. I don't think people really know what it means when we say 50% better screen contrast. Mm-hmm. But I think how easy on the eyes looking at that text is will become apparent as soon as people look at it.
Mm.
And maybe the one other thing I'd say is just, it's only the kind of thing that you really appreciate once you're walking around with one, is the battery life.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, I know how hard I have to work, not just daily, but sometimes multiple times a day, to keep certain devices I have, phones and other things, charged, right? We walk around,
yeah,
like fearing, oh my God, I don't have my charger with me.
Yeah.
And I think people really appreciate not having to worry about that.
Yeah, and most trips you go on, you're just not even going to have to take the charger with you.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this example a lot, but it's still true. I travel a bunch, and when the airplane door closes, I want to know that I'm going to be able to read all the way through the flight.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I panic a little if I just have my phone, because, you know, it feels like the battery drains even while the damn thing's off.
Yeah.
And so we've worked very hard to try and really minimize the power requirements of the device so that battery can last as long as possible.
I've got a friend of mine who took a Kindle into Denali Park with a friend of his who was, you know, kind of an ebook basher. And so the friend took a couple of print books, and they were in for about a week. And what happened was that my friend that brought the Kindle was still reading content from his library toward the end of the trip, and his friend was reading the Cabela's catalog that happened to be at the Park,
yep,
Service hut. And that's,
yep,
when he just realized that, you know, these things, because of the battery life and the memory, it puts you in a whole different realm of being able to read.
Yeah. And listen, there are two other things that I think, you know, you asked me for a thing, and I'm doing a bad job giving you a single thing, but I think each of them, I don't think people completely perceive the power of yet. The first one is the price.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean to sound like a Ginsu knife commercial, but, you know, people were paying $189 for a device a few weeks ago, and, mm-hmm, like, you know, but wait, there's more. You,
yeah,
know, so the new device comes at the same price point with all these feature improvements. But in addition, as you know, we have the Wi-Fi only version for $139. And, you know, that price point, I think, is starting to reach yet a whole nother possible audience.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a student, I suspect on college campuses these days that Wi-Fi is reasonably ubiquitous, mm-hmm. you know, in your dorm, in your classroom, whatever. So a lot of people find themselves in environments where they can be attached to a wireless network all the time. So that price point, you know, for the small number of times they may not be attached to a wireless network, may be a great entry point.
Yeah.
And it'll be the kind of thing that make for multi-Kindle families.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that, you know, we're seeing a nice, long, steady trend on is, and this isn't related to the device specifically, but the device is important in thinking about it, and that is the sort of buy once, read everywhere piece. You know, particularly now, like, we just launched Kindle for Android 6 or 7 weeks ago, and we've seen great uptake there, and just the number of people that complement their use of the device with the use of their phone or tablet or whatever is a really, really big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ability with Kindle to build a library and think, even if you own a tablet computer and an Android phone, I don't have to choose where to read my books. My books follow me wherever I want to go. I think more and more people are kind of open, you know, waking up. Like, there'll be a moment where they don't have their reader with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're on some long line, and they can spend 15 minutes getting through another however many pages of the novel they're reading on their phone. That's a really big deal for people.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the other big bit of news that came in sort of the same time frame was your opening of the UK Kindle store. And
yeah.
There was some interesting analysis that Stephen Windwalker did on his Kindle Nation blog, where he found at least a few books that had dramatically lower prices in the UK
yep.
store, and he was suggesting that the difference was no agency model pricing in the UK. But is that the main factor there, or what are some of the other things going on in pricing for the UK store?
Well, it is true that there are today some books in the UK store that are on the classic wholesale model that are under agency in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not universally true. So mm-hmm. if you take, like, for example, the most popular books today, which are Stieg Larsson books, they're sold by Random House. They're priced under the wholesale model in both markets. One other really important thing about the UK market is it really is a market with much lower print book prices. So if you compared the actual print book price of bestsellers in the UK versus the US, you'd see also dramatic price reductions in the UK. There are any number of reasons why that's true, relating to sort of who sells books and sort of what the structure looks like. There's also a much larger propensity for new books to just come out in paperback as opposed to hardcover, which also changes some of the pricing dynamics. So there's a whole lot of different factors, particular to the UK market, that make pricing generally in all formats somewhat lower than the US.
Hmm. Now, I had a listener who was irritated at seeing a book cheaper in the UK market, and I think he was really irritated at the publishers that are forcing
right.
the higher prices of the agency model, say, well, can I just log in on the UK store and buy them there?
Yeah.
I suspect that's not possible, but I thought I'd ask you what's...
That is not possible. So, you know, if any of your listeners know that the market for books, for publishing books, is often divided up into territories. So a different publisher might own the rights to the book in the UK versus the US. They set totally different list prices. They have different terms with their customers. And so, you know, there are a lot of cases where, you know, one hand isn't even washing the other. It's not mm-hmm. like an individual publisher's strategy. So it can happen for a variety of reasons. We've been consistent in our dislike of the agency model. We think the publishers who have forced that model on booksellers and on reading customers are frequently charging needlessly high prices for books. I can tell you that our team is continuing to try and work with people to, irrespective of the economics between us and the publisher, which is readers don't and shouldn't care about,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to to make sure that we have what we think are very reasonable prices for ebooks. And you know, customers are smart. They know that ebooks shouldn't cost as much as print books. So that's like a starting point. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever we charge for the print version of a book, we think the ebook should be that price or lower, and almost always lower. That's our goal. That's our belief. We're doing our best to make that happen, and we'll continue to work with publishers to try and help them get there too. Mm.
So if someone logs on to the internet from the U.S., just to protect these territorial rights, there's a kind of a technology way to keep them from buying something in the U.K. store, I suppose.
Right. Well, everybody, for example, the geography in which your credit card is based is okay. An example of how we would determine someone's territory.
I see. Interesting.
There are a number of different factors, and it is possible, if you're a U.S. resident and you happen to be living somewhere for a little while or traveling, we'll treat you as a U.S. customer, but we have ways of helping ensure that if somebody really is part of Territory X, that, we ask them to be treated as a resident of that country.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, now the other thing I wanted to ask you about is Google Editions, and I had a chance to get some insight into what's apparently coming there because my mother has a book which I listed with the Google Books program, and they had a page that said, if you want your book to be ready for Google Editions, fill out this form, in which I did. And then I sent them a question. I said, my mom doesn't care about rights management, and it sure would be great if we could read her book on the Kindle when it comes out in Google Editions. And that's where they sent this reply saying that Kindle will not be a supported Google Edition device at launch, though we are open to supporting them in the future. And then they said that you would be able to read her book as a DRM-free PDF. But apparently this is for real. I've heard people say, Google Editions has been talked about for so long, is it really ever going to come? But having seen this actual response from their team, it looks like it's coming. But what can you say about Google Editions and the possibility that at some point there'll be the ability to have Kindle be a supported device?
Well, first, a couple things on that. First, it's entirely up to Google Editions if they want to offer books in a format that can be read on Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very easy for them to do.
They would just put them in as Mobi, and that would be that, huh?
Correct. We actually have software, which you probably know about, called Kindle Gen, where you can take any EPUB file and create a Mobi file. Mm-hmm. So, you'd have to sort of ask them why they don't create a Mobi format of any of the books they're selling.
Hmm. Because a lot of places do. I mean, FictionWise and some of the other sources for ebooks on the web have multiple.
If a Google edition can't be read on a Kindle device, it's their decision. The other thing I'd say is if a PDF is going to be available of a Google edition, you probably know that's one of the formats that's supported natively on the device. The personal document service, anybody can send a document to their Kindle in a lot of different formats. It can be a Word doc, it can be HTML, it can be PDF, obviously the Mobi format, all work on Kindle. And, you could even just take that file as an output and just email it to your Kindle account and read it on your Kindle.
Yeah, and the drawback would be you wouldn't have the ability to do some of the things you could in a Mobi or an AZW format.
Yeah. Our preference would be for them to create Mobi versions of their books so people could read them on their Kindle devices.
Hmm. Well, does it sort of hurt your feelings that yours is the only format that they're not apparently going to include?
I think we can, we can't control what other folks do. We can just do our best to build the best reading platform and offer the widest selection possible. And really, more than the nominal format, whatever the technical format that the container is that the book goes in, what people care a lot about is interoperability and ubiquity of use. And obviously that's what we are heads down focused on at Kindle. The vast majority of devices that people use in their lives every day, whether it's a PC or a Mac, Android phone, an iPhone, iPad, BlackBerry, your Kindle library will work any of those places. And our commitment is to keep working and investing and making it possible for people to read their device, their library of books anywhere they want to read them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to another subject that interests me, and that's social media. You know, I've heard, watched Jeff's interview with Charlie Rose, and there really has been a consistent and I think clear message about being purpose-built for reading. But my question is, do you think reading is solitary or is it social? And when you think of purpose built for reading at kind of a philosophical level or an understanding of the essence of it, how much do you think it's social and therefore things like your Twitter and your Facebook capabilities are just sort of the start of things that you'd be doing? Or how do you describe reading on that dimension?
There's really give and take relationship between people and the devices they use. Jeff is fond of saying that our tools evolve with us and we evolve with our tools, right? And the tool that is the print book, which is an extraordinary device that served us well for five centuries. It's low cost and portable, it's high resolution, it's pretty durable. Like, it's actually a really good device for the things that it does, which is why building an electronic reading device is so difficult, because we have to compete with this book. That's a very, very good device at what it does.
Mm-hmm.
But reading a print book, the activity of reading, has largely been a solitary activity. Now, of course, there are examples of where people have read aloud to others and other things, but, you know, the primary mode for reading a book is a solitary activity.
Right.
So we want to make sure, but and when we say purpose-built reading device, we mean a device that works for the purposes that people want.
Mm.
And the mode that most people are used to when they're reading now is a solitary activity. But slowly, because the device is, now this is how the tools change us, right?
Right.
Suddenly you have a Kindle device that as soon as I read a passage, maybe I'm reading a business book and I found a passage that's particularly insightful and I want to tweet it to all the people that follow me, that's now possible in just a couple of strokes on the keyboard. And, you know, I think over time, our behavior and our awareness about reading being social may well increase because the tools allow that to happen.
Hmm.
So I don't think it's you can think about it as a binary, it's solitary or it's not. I suspect in different contexts, people will be in different modes of, you know, maybe you're reading this book for class, I want to share things with the people in my class. I'm just doing this for myself, and I really don't have any interest in telling anyone else about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, different customers will like, different readers will like that, but the tools will make that possible, and it'll be very interesting to see in the coming years how the mix of social activity versus just continuing to make reading a solitary activity, sort of how that plays out.
Yeah, and it ties to your often stated desire to be the most customer-focused or customer-centric company. And it raises the question in my mind, as your customers' purposes change because of the possibilities of the technology, do you want to be slightly ahead of where they are or wait until they are clearly saying we want social reading? Or what's your position as they change what they want?
Well, I'll offer a way that we think about that, which is for the primary activity of reading, we are very reluctant to add any features or make any changes to the device or the reading experience.
Mm-hmm.
That takes away from that.
Okay.
So you can add things.
As long as they don't detract.
Don't detract from the primary activity. That's what purpose-built means.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, can you tweet or Facebook some passage in a book? Yes. If you don't care about that, the device never gets in your way.
Mm.
You know, it's another reason why, we've started launching active content and things for the device. I mean, just the first couple of things. It's the very, very beginning of this.
Mm-hmm.
But one of our preconditions is that enabling that possibility shouldn't detract at all from someone who just wants to read 300-page novels.
Yeah, exactly.
People ask us about color a lot. And I think if once e-ink technology or another technology that allows for light to reflect off the screen and not emit, which causes eye strain and battery life and all those other things. Once that evolves to the point where you can offer color in a way that does not detract from the black and white reading experience, we'd be delighted to edit.
Mm-hmm. And probably it wouldn't detract if you were able to do it within those parameters where you still had the reflective.
And the battery life mm-hmm. and all the other things that matter for people. You know, mm-hmm. so we've seen some of the color technology in the lab, and it's not ready yet because the trade-offs we'd have to make relative to the primary activity for which mm-hmm. the device is built are just too great.
Hmm. Interesting.
Same thing with touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried out one of the Sony Daily Editions, and the touch was great, but it totally made kind of a murky look to the screen and the readability.
It's lower contrast, and it's also, I don't know if depending on where you looked at it, but there's a lot of glare.
Yeah, exactly right.
So adding that other plate on top of the e-ink screen, now the light has to go twice through that second plate,
mm-hmm.
which reduces contrast and creates the glare problem.
Mm.
So, you know, when 95%+ of the time you spend with the device, you're not interacting with the menu.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though touch would be nice, you know, we're not willing to do that if what it does is take away from that primary activity.
Mm-hmm.
So that to us, that's what purpose built means. You can add all the new stuff you want that maybe drive people in new directions or make things possible that weren't possible before. But we won't do that. In doing that, we will not sacrifice
mm-hmm.
the primary activity.
Yeah, that you can pursue both purposes without there being a conflict.
Correct.
Every word in Shuffled Row I've tried out; those are pretty cool. Am I right in considering them the first two Kindle apps?
Yeah.
And
they're early. They're primitive in any number of ways. It's just kind of our first crack at, you know, getting them out there and seeing what reaction is. And it's been great. We've got a lot of people are excited about it,
mm-hmm.
And lots of feedback, good and bad. And that's, you know, that's the whole point of the process.
After Jeff's mention of the Angry Birds game on the iPad, I would you be open to a Kindle version of Angry Birds?
As long as it didn't detract from the reading experience.
Exactly.
So Jeff's point there is not that there's anything wrong with Angry Birds.
Yeah.
Angry Birds is great.
It's fun. I had a great time playing it.
It's not a value judgment. It's just that, you know, Stieg Larsson being number one is the case because the device is built for that purpose. So what are people doing? They're reading. That's why it's number one on that device.
Yeah. Now, one question. He said that what people are doing most on the Kindle versus the iPad, and I had one listener mm-hmm. say, does this mean they can tell what I'm reading on my Kindle? That probably was just based on the sales, right?
Yeah. The comment he made was just based upon what's the number one seller on
right.
each device as a proxy for what people are doing.
Yeah,
I mean, we also don't have any idea what people are doing on iPads.
Yeah.
We just know what the lists look like.
Yeah,
in
the rankings.
Store.
Great. Well, terrific. Anything else breaking today or recently that you'd like to discuss? This would be a great chance to make some
a
news
great place
here.
To break things. Well, yeah. Obviously, we're trying to you know, get the news to folks as fast as we're prepared to talk about it, and. We're really excited about the new devices.
Yeah.
I think people should order and get in line, and we'll get them the device as soon as possible. And I don't think we're going to have to push the date too much further based upon what we're seeing now and also our ability to get things manufactured. So that's very exciting. And we got more tricks in store, but you're just going to have to stay tuned.
Okay. Well, your team does a good job getting the word out. I thought that I really appreciated the chance to try out the device in Boston with Stephanie and Jay. So that part of your operation is going pretty smoothly.
Great. Well, it's our pleasure, Len. Thank you. And I mean, you know, it's we're gratified by your interest and by your audience's interest. So thank you very much.
This was my second opportunity to speak with Russ Grandinetti for the podcast, and I really appreciate the time he made available, as well as his openness in responding to fairly probing questions that a less confident corporate executive might have been tempted to duck with party line platitudes instead of what I found to be pretty thoughtful and helpful replies. It was the same when I spoke with him the first time for episode TKC 101 posted on June 25th of this year. So if you haven't heard that one yet, you might want to check it out. I also want to thank Stephanie for her sustained efforts to get this interview on the calendar in time for this week's show. In content this week, what if you had a great idea for a book that you'd been working on, like, say, a consideration of immigration, and as you got close to finishing it, you realized it's a very timely topic that would probably find an eager audience now, as opposed to, say, a year from now, which is how long it might take to publish your book in paper. Even if you didn't know much about this e-books thing, you might be open to considering an e-book-only publication, right? Well, that seems to be what happened to Pete Hamill, described by the New York Times headline writer as a patriarch of print in a story by the Times' Julie Bosman. She reported this week that Hamill's They Are Us will skip print altogether and be published only as an ebook. Since Hamill's other books are available in the Kindle store, I assume that we'll be able to read his new one on Kindle when it's published this fall by Little Brown and Company. Hamill admitted to Bosman that he's never read an ebook, adding, quote, "But I don't have any moral superiority. I don't care as long as people are reading." Bosman tells a great story of how Little Brown's publisher came up with the idea, and Hamill agreed to it even before he had ever seen an e-reader. Then he came into the Little Brown office, where the publisher had laid out an assortment of devices, including an iPad, Kindle, iPhone, and Sony Reader. Hamill, who is 75, is now reportedly trying to figure out which device to buy, and he's said to be leaning toward an iPad. Since he told Bosman the reason he prefers print books is so that he can curl up in a corner in a comfortable chair, I hope someone in Hamill's circle will point out that he will have a lot more fun curling up with an 8-ounce third-generation Kindle than he would with a pound and a half of iPad. In any event, I'm looking forward to buying Hamill's book on immigration as soon as it's available, and I expect it won't be the last time a nonfiction book goes straight to ebook for a timely connection with readers who are interested in waiting for the topic. I've got time now to pass along one comment. This is from Alan Morris, thanking me for mentioning his project of scanning and digitizing a book called The Last Enemy. I'm leaving for Italy today, he writes, and hope to come back refreshed and ready for my next course of treatment. I've already selected my next book for conversion, The Performing Flea by P.G. Wodehouse, and hope to get the scanning of the book done on my Italian niece's Mac when I'm over there. This book has not been in print for a significant amount of time and is more complex technically than The Last Enemy, so I look forward to the challenge. It is viewed as an important book on the art of writing, so another book that deserves to survive and inform and educate future generations. I really enjoy being a part of your show and hope to take up your offer of an interview when feeling better. It really has helped to motivate me to continue to fight to get better, and I thank you for your kindness and best wishes. Thanks, Alan, for that comment, and I'll look forward to hearing about your new project. I want to let you know that together with Joshua Talent, founder and CEO of eBook Architects in Austin, I have proposed a panel for the 2011 South by Southwest Interactive Conference. It's titled How You Can Survive the eBook Revolution, and I hope you might consider stopping by the panel picker description of it to help with a vote and a comment. The panel picker is an important part of the process of choosing which panel proposals will actually be accepted for the conference, so your support in this would be much appreciated. Joshua has been on the podcast twice, and his knowledge of ebooks ranges from details of formatting to wise insights in overall publishing trends. We plan to offer helpful tips and insights into the ebook revolution. If you have not created a South by Southwest username and password, you'll need to do that before posting a comment and voting for my proposal. It's free, just takes a minute, and it doesn't commit you to attend or anything else. I'll have a link in the show notes, or you can find it yourself at panelpicker.sxsw.com. On that page, scroll down a bit, you'll see Explore the Proposals for South by Southwest Interactive. Click on that, and then in the search form, under panel title, just enter the word ebook with a hyphen and you'll come to it. And finally, I want to alert you that there will be a new initiative announced early next week at ebooksfortroops.org. So I hope you'll check that out, especially if you are looking for a worthy cause that could do something great with your Kindle too, thereby preparing the way for your pre-order of a new Kindle Wi-Fi or Kindle Wi-Fi in 3G. Ken Clark and I are very excited about this project, and I'll have details to pass along to you in next week's podcast. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA Promonet. This is Len Edgerly from Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.